5. Hospital Radio. In 1967, I misdiagnosed myself with cancer of the ball bag. In every other respect, I was a perfectly normal youth. I was active, I had a good diet, I was pubing well. But one day, I found a lump. For 3 long days, I felt the cold hand of death on my shoulder. Lost in the depths of despair, I tried to figure out what I had done to deserve this. I wasn't an evil person. The worst thing I'd done was kick a pig. It was a school trip to Heston Farm in 1964, and I maintained it was self-defense. It's not even as if I wanted to live a particularly long life. As a child, I would have been satisfied to reach my mid-30s. To be honest, I just wanted to best Christ. Yet it seemed I wouldn't get the chance. As I sat in the doctor's waiting room, I pulled out a notepad and began to draw up my final will and testament. It was almost as if, even at the age of 12, I was somehow aware of the tax implications of dying intestate. But before the pencil lead had dried on the paper, I was spared. A quick medical fondle by Dr. Armitage had identified the suspected tumour was nothing more sinister than an infected paper cut, a result, I later realised, of a clandestine word search puzzle done under my duvet after lights off. The heat from my head-mounted caver's torch had made it impractical to continue without removing my gym jams, and it was then I must have nicked my scrotum. I may have cheated death on that bitter February morn, but I had learnt a valuable lesson. I had learnt what it felt like to stare death in the face, and also what it felt like to have its cold hand on your shoulder. And I believe it was this knowledge that helped me make such an unmitigated success of my first job in broadcasting. Snowflakes fell from the sky, like tiny pieces of a snowman who had stood on a landmine. If he was particularly unlucky, it would have been a bouncing Betty. These horrible little devices are designed to spring 3 feet into the air before exploding and inflicting the maximum number of casualties on an enemy. I think they've won awards. My wipers scurried across my windscreen, back and forth, back and forth, back and... My God, was that the time? I had just 5 minutes to get to work. And so help me God, nothing! Other than perhaps the weather and the roadworks at the top of Chalk Hill Road, and the distance I still had to travel, was going to stop me. For the last 3 years, I had been a hospital radio DJ at St. Luke's in Norwich. It was a smashing little hospital, and many of the people who went there didn't end up dead. I loved my job, though, and despite being unpaid, I'd been quick to negotiate free parking and the right to jump the queue in the canteen. This never went down well, but the patients were often too weak to oppose me. But I hated being late, because the inmates needed me. And while no one would be silly enough to claim that my trademark mix of great chat, decent pop, and amusing homemade jingles could take all their pain away, it did take the edge off, and it was definitely more helpful than homeopathy. 6 minutes later, I pressed the red button and spoke into the microphone. Whoa, yeah, call off the search party. I'm here, it's 8:01, and this is Alan Partridge. Or should I say the late Alan Partridge? Perhaps not, because that would suggest I was dead, and I am not. But here's a list of people who are. You'll notice from this that I had a much brasher broadcasting style in my early days, my speech peppered with laughs and shouts and whoops. Soon after Good Morning Vietnam came out, I'd even begin shows with the holler, Good Morning St. Luke's! However, I was upbraided for this and told it called to mind a war zone littered with the injured and diseased, which was precisely why I'd thought it was so appropriate. As DJing gigs go, it was far harder than people realise. Yes, you have a captive audience, but you also have a listenership that is almost exclusively poorly, and that makes song selection a delicate business. One wrong step, and you could instantly offend a fairly meaty percentage of patients. Just take the number one singles from my first year in the job, 1975. Almost all of them were capable of upsetting someone. Art Garfunkel's I Only Have Eyes For You, The Recently Blinded. David Essex's Hold Me Close, Burns Victims. The Stylistics' Can't Give You Anything, The Terminally Ill. Tammy Wynette's Stand By Your Man, Paralyzed Women, Paralyzed Homosexual Men. In my time at the hospital, I was broadcasting live during the deaths of some 800 patients. It's a record that stands to this day. Industry awards and repeated praise from TV Quick magazine are all very well, but it gives me immense pride to think that the final voice these 800-plus people heard may have been mine, as I read the traffic and travel or introduced a clip from my favourite Goon Show LP. I spent 94 wonderful months behind the mic at St. Luke's, but by autumn 1983, much like most of the patients on the Marie Curie wing, my days were numbered. I guess I always knew that as word of my competence leaked out across Anglia, my head might be hunted. And so it was that in September, I answered the phone to local media mogul Rich Shayers. "Alan, you've done your time on hospital radio. It's time to spread your wings." "What, like a bird?" I asked, keen to know more. "I'm starting a new station, and I want you on board." "Will I get loads of salary?" I blurted. I was young and unsure how to phrase questions relating to remuneration. "Just swing by my office tomorrow, and we can hammer all that out." "Great," I replied. "I'll bring the hammers." And with that, my career changed forever. But there was to be a moving postscript to this chapter in my life, and I'll tell you about it now. At my leaving do with the party in full swing, I stopped the music, climbed atop a chair, and gave the hospital staff an emotional, heartfelt guarantee. I pledged, no matter how famous I became, that while there was still air in my lungs, I would come back and do my show for a minimum of 1 week every year. I may not have been able to donate money, but in some ways I was able to donate something far more powerful. I was able to donate chat to a maximum value of 1 week each year. And with that, I picked up my coat and left the building, the warm applause of my colleagues still ringing in my ears like a big church bell. Sadly, circumstances meant that I've not been able to get back to the hospital in the intervening 31 years. In the main, that's down to me. Work commitments have made it simply unfeasible. But for the record, I'd like to point out that the hospital is not entirely blameless itself. In 2001, it moved to a new site around the corner from the University of East Anglia. The studios from where I used to broadcast my show were reduced to rubble, and I think most reasonable people would agree that by allowing that to happen, the NHS Trust effectively voided my promise.